Well, Revelation 8 begins the tribulation trumpets. This point in history, we're at the great tribulation. Eventually, there will be the second coming of Jesus. He's going to inaugurate the millennial kingdom and then the new heavens and new earth. So far, we're just here. And truly, the book of Revelation is predominantly about this seven-year window where God is going to let go of the reins of humanity and just let us do whatever we want. No more restraining. No more common grace. Instead, he's just going to let us go. And this is the darkest period in human history. Jesus said there will be a great tribulation, such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever will again. Unless those days had been cut short, no life would have been saved. So this period that the Bible refers to as the Great Tribulation, this is going to be so bad that Jesus said God had to intervene before we just completely wiped ourselves out. We already studied the seals. These are symbols to describe the judgment that's going to come on the earth. And now we're in the trumpets. Later we'll be in the bowls. And as you can see, these overlap. So in Revelation 6, you get the big picture of the church age all the way up to the end. Now, Revelation 8 and 9, we're in that seventh seal. See that? Then once we get to the seventh trumpet, that's where the bowls come in. So you get the big picture, and then you get more intensification, and then you get even more intensification once you get to the bowls. Right now, we're at the trumpets. Scholars, when they read Revelation 8 and 9, they say, well, these are basically allusions back to the 10 plagues of Egypt. And as we read this, you're certainly going to see that many of the judgments are given in the form, the symbolism of the judgments of Egypt. The 10 plagues, let my people go, you know what I'm talking about, Exodus. However, that's all they have to say. That's the end of it. They're like, yeah, well, this refers to the Nile River. This refers to this. And they just basically refer and allude back to the Exodus. But here's my question. Yes, these are allusions to the 10 plagues, but were those literal plagues or were they allegorical plagues? Ask Pharaoh. That was my one joke for the night. That totally bombed. That was it. That was it, guys. It's all downhill from here. All right, Revelation 8:1. When he opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for half an hour. Up until this point in the book, there's been nothing but volume pumping out of heaven. People are shouting, they're screaming, they're singing. And now, hush. That was 10 seconds. Was that uncomfortable? Raise your hand if you felt uncomfortable by that. Yeah, everyone does. Everyone hates silence. In heaven, you go from this screaming, shouting, singing to for half an hour. This is the imagery of the jury coming out to give the verdict to the people in the court. When they come out, everyone just goes silent. Well, at this point, I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and seven trumpets were given to them. Seven trumpets. Another angel who had a golden censer came and stood at the altar. He was given much incense to offer with the prayers of all of God's people on the golden altar in front of the throne. The smoke of the incense together with the prayers of God's people went up before God from the angel's hand, and then the angel took the censer filled with fire from the altar and hurled it on the earth. And there came peals of thunder, rumblings, flashings of lightning, and an earthquake. This is the answer to the prayers of those believers back in Revelation chapter 6, verses 9 through 11, where they said, how long, O Lord? How long are you going to allow this to occur? And God says, it's being answered right now. This is it. Judgment for the earth. All these people who were murdered, tortured, God says, now we're going to come in with judgment for these people. Verse 6, then the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared to sound them. The first angel sounded his trumpet, and there came hail and fire mixed with blood, and it was hurled down on the earth. Hail and fire mixed with blood. Remember I said you got these seals, and then it's recapitulated, the trumpets, and then recapped, and you got the bowls. Well, here in the bowl judgments, Revelation 16:21, same thing, hail and fire mixed with blood. We learn that these hailstones are 100 pounds. That's how big they are. Wow, 100-pound hailstones. And we learn a third of the earth was burned up, a third of the trees were burned up, and all the green grass was burned up. What do the commentators, scholars, say about this? Here's an older scholar, Thomas Newton. This refers to the Goths invading the Roman Empire, twice besieging Rome and setting fire to it. Attila and his sons waste the Roman provinces and force the emperors to, quote, submit to shameful terms. This is in the 5th century AD. Couldn't you see that from the hail mixed with blood and the third of the earth getting ready? Couldn't you see Attila the Hun in that? Am I the only one that's like, are we reading the same book here? This is supposed to comment on what we're reading. Matthew Henry, another older scholar. This is 1994. That's when it was published. He goes way back. He's not sure what this is. He's like, this could be the clergy and the laity. That's what's being described here. A third of the earth and a third of the trees and the green grass. This is one third of the clergy and the laity. Or great men and common people. The trees refer to great men and then a third to common people. Or it could refer to Rome being one-third of the world. Or, he says, maybe just a one-third judgment on Rome. Again, I look at this text and I'm like, what the hell? How did you come to that conclusion? The clergy and the laity, like the leaders and the people in the group? Is that really? You say, well, those are old commentators. The new ones are worse. They're even worse. Here's William Hendrickson. He says, throughout the period, ending from the first coming of Jesus, AD 33, to the second coming in the future, our Lord, who now reigns in heaven, will afflict the persecutors of the church with various disasters that will take place on earth. So, all of these hail and fire and blood and a great mountain and a torch and all of this is from God to judge persecutors of the church for the last 2,000 years. If you're like me and you're looking at this, you're just like, I have no idea where you got that. Moreover, floods also afflict Christians. Fire, famine affects Christians. It affects us just as much as any persecutors. Dr. Robert Mulholland. Now, this guy has a PhD out of Harvard. This is what he says. What is this? The third of the trees and the hail and fire mixed with blood? Quote, as a consequence of the fall, the sea becomes dangerous and inimical, hostile, to human life. Creation has fallen from its perfection and has become incomplete. That's why it's one-third incomplete. Like if you cut up a pizza into one-third, 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 you don't have the full pizza. So the one-third is describing how creation had a fall, and it's describing the creation. This is just all describing the fall. Revelation 8 and 9, it's just the fall. I didn't mean to laugh maniacally there, but I'm just like, I read these guys before I go to bed sometimes and I can't sleep. I'm just like, where did he come up with that? The vision reminds us that we live in a seriously flawed creation. Humanity attempts valiantly to bring the adverse powers of the created order under its control, but to no avail. Oh, come on, give me a break. Here, what was John seeing? A little bit of common sense goes a really long way when we're trying to interpret this, and you sitting here tonight, you have the text right in front of you. What is it saying? According to the opening verses of this book, Revelation 1:1 to 3, we read that John is seeing visions of the future. Jesus made it known, semino. You might recognize that word from our study in the gospel according to John. Jesus had 7 semeia, signs. The turning of the water into wine, the feeding of the 5,000, the raising of Lazarus, right? All of those were literal events, but they had symbolic significance. The turning of the water into the wine was describing how God is bringing a party, in his kingdom. The feeding of the people, the raising of Lazarus, all of these had symbolic connotations. However, they really occurred. Same thing here. Jesus is going to make known, by sending his angel to his servant John, who testifies to everything he saw. How were these revelations imparted, these visions imparted to John? He saw them. That's what it says right there. Blessed is the one who reads aloud the words of this prophecy. Revelation is in the apocalyptic genre. However, it's also in the prophetic genre. It's not just one genre. It claims to be a work of prophecy predicting the future. So, what did John see? What we're going to see is that when we read the book of Revelation, he's seeing visions. And in each one of these visions, to a first century individual, you'd be looking at something in the future for which you don't have words. So John is going to use the language of simile repeatedly. It's like a mountain. It's as a star. It's like, as, like. He's groping at words. It's the same as us today using the word of idiom when we say, look, a shooting star. Now, we don't literally mean that a big, you know, gas giant, thermonuclear giant is crashing across our sky. It's a meteorite burning up. But we see it and we're like, it looks like a star and it's shooting, so we call it a shooting star. John is trying to get words to describe what it is that he's seeing. And throughout this section, the context for the book of Revelation and the tribulation is warfare. This is just replete throughout this book. Remember in Revelation 6, take peace from the earth, men would slay one another. There's going to be battles in chapter 9, armies, war, commanders. You read the Old Testament prophets that speak about this period, and it's the same picture. War. There's going to be war right before Jesus returns. When Jesus returns, you're going to see war preceding him. So now, that was a little excursus, how to interpret. Could this be literal hail? Yeah, I mean, it could be, possibly. You know, God has no more difficulty creating a 100-pound hail ball than he would creating anything else. An omnipotent God isn't limited. The biggest piece of hail is about the size of a grapefruit, though. That's like the Guinness World Record, 2 pounds. This is 100 pounds of hail per stone. Hails also don't mix with fire very well. They're usually ice. Actually, they're always ice. And they don't mix with fire or blood. You don't have blood balls of ice, fire, falling from the sky. Hail doesn't burn the land. That's what we just read. Hard to believe. Hard to believe this is literal hail. Blood. Hail mixed with blood and fire. Blood is a symbol of judgment. And we get that in the extra-biblical, you know, Greek authors, Roman authors. We see that in the Bible as well. When there's a blood sacrifice, it's for judgment. So what are we seeing here? This is some sort of a depiction, a picture of what it looks like to look into the future, 20 centuries, and see these huge 100-pound hailstones, is what he calls it, falling to the earth. Could have looked something like this. Like, how would you describe that if you were John? It's these big things, and they're really dangerous, but they're on fire. You know, it's not hail, but it is. And it falls down, and when it lands, man, it burns everything up. Third of the grass, third of the trees, third of the earth. That could be what he's looking at. Now, am I saying that is what he saw? No. I'm saying that that fits with what we know in modern warfare, and that fits what we know this description would be. We read from the second angel, when he sounded his trumpet, something like a huge mountain all ablaze was thrown into the sea. Some people punt to First Enoch. this kills me. All right, I'm just going to make a little sermonette here. Don't jump to the extra-biblical literature when the book of Revelation is steeped in the Old Testament. Like, the book of Revelation alludes to the Old Testament 200 times. And yet we're going to say, well, we're going to pull out of First Enoch what we think this means. I think that is nonsense. I think it's a bad mistake. And no, it's not just a regular angel. Some people look at the Old Testament and they say, well, angels can be described as a Babylon the Great, both in the Old Testament and in Revelation 17 and 18. So maybe this is describing the huge mountain is Babylon, and this is on fire and it's getting thrown into the sea. See, I don't know why that would be judgment. This seems like this is bringing the judgment, and then it's burning up everything else. What we're seeing here is that this image is that it's burning and it's bringing judgment to the earth, not the other way around. I'm going with observational language. Look at the language, simile. Something like a huge mountain, all ablaze, was thrown into the sea. Okay, he knows what a normal mountain would look like. Pompeii, AD 79, explodes. Volcanoes, fiery mountains. You would know what that would look like. A mountain falling into the sea, though. An inverted mountain on fire, falling down from the sky into the water. That would be different. Yeah, and we see as well a third of the sea turned into blood, a third of the living creatures in the sea died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. So much for this being the Goths and Attila the Hun and just living in a fallen world. No, it's describing this massive rock falling into the sea, and then it kills a bunch of stuff, right? Can we at least agree on that, whether the third is literal? It kills a bunch of stuff, ships, living creatures, aquatic life, sea. The third angel sounded his trumpet, and a great star, blazing like a torch, fell from the sky on a third of the rivers and the springs. Blazing like a torch. They would know what a torch looked like. But this is, again, this is falling down from the sky. I wonder if you saw something like that. A torch inverted, falling down onto the earth. Again, I'm not saying this is what he saw. I'm saying to an ancient reader, if you're seeing the future, how would you describe this? How would you be able to depict this in words? It's like a torch falling to the ground. And this is no regular torch. It has a name. The star is called wormwood. That was a bitter herb back at the time. And when this thing that's like a torch lands in the water, a third of the water turns bitter. Many people died after they drank that wormwood water. Something like a torch goes into the water, poisons the water, and then when you drink it, you die. What is that describing? In the first century, this would make little to no sense. Today, something like a torch falling from the sky into the water, poisoning the water, and making people die as a result of drinking the water, that makes perfect sense in a thermonuclear world where we have war like that. Well, we read in verse 12, the fourth angel sounded his trumpet, and a third of the sun was struck, a third of the moon, and a third of the stars. A third of them turned dark. A third of the day was without light, and also a third of the night. So it's this image that when you're looking up at the sky, you've got all of this fiery stuff falling from heaven. And it's not just the sea. It's not just the trees or the water. The sky itself turns hazy. Now again, in our modern world, this makes perfect sense. If you had warfare like this, the soot, the everything else being cooked up into the atmosphere would create a total glaze. Not like making the sun opaque, but making it something like this, really, really messed up. Well, he concludes, as I watched, I heard an eagle that was flying in the midair, calling out in a loud voice, "Woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth, because of the trumpet blast about to be sounded by the other three angels." Three more trumpets to go next week. Whew. All right. What did we get from that? What is the summary of the data? The data demonstrate at least two things. Number one, there's different kinds of massive burning objects falling into the earth. Can we at least agree on that? I don't know what they were. I'm not saying that they're missiles. I'm not saying that they're nuclear weapons. I'm also not saying that they're not missiles or nuclear weapons. They could very well be. I am saying that whatever it is, it's massive and it's on fire and it comes into the earth. And the result is that the land, a third of it is burned up. third of the sea is poisoned, and the sky is darkened by a third. Is this a plausible scenario? No, not to a first century writer like John. It is very plausible today. Meteors falling to earth. Here's Dr. Toby Orr. This is from his book, The Precipice. He's out of Oxford. He says the meteor that killed the dinosaurs was roughly 6 miles in diameter. He says it releases the energy of 10 billion Hiroshima blasts, 10,000 times the entire Cold War nuclear arsenal, 65 million years ago when that meteorite struck. This is the amount of power that was released as a result of this meteor. He writes this, everything within 1,000 kilometers is killed by heat from the impact of the fireball. A tsunami devastates the Caribbean. Trillions of tons of rock and dust are thrown up far into the sky. Some of this superheated rock rains down over millions of square kilometers, burning the animals to death and igniting fires that spread the devastation still further. A billowing cloud of dust and ash rises all the way to the upper atmosphere, blocking out the sun's light. Yeah, that's what would happen if you have an asteroid meteor striking. It is this that turns regional catastrophe to mass extinction. Slowly, it spreads across the entire world, engulfing it in darkness, lasting years. With the darkness comes a severe global cooling, for the sun's light is blocked by the dust and reflected off the haze of the sulfate aerosols released when the sea floor was vaporized. The cold and the dark kills plants across the globe. Animals starve or freeze. The 100 million year reign of the dinosaurs ends. 3/4 of all species on Earth are annihilated. It's happened before. And if it happened again, this would fit like a hand in a glove with what we're reading in Revelation. How likely is this, that we're going to be struck by a meteor that's somewhere in the 1 to 10 kilometer range or bigger in diameter? Not that likely. NASA currently has 19 out of 20 asteroids marked with where they're going to hit and rotate. However, there is 1 out of 20 that are unaccounted for. We don't have them all. NASA, as of 10 years ago, had a $4 million budget for this. That's not a lot. That's not a lot to be able to totally picture and figure out where all of the asteroids are coming. Possible, not that likely, however. I'm putting my money on this is what John saw. Nuclear war. In his day, they didn't have explosions. They had fire. Nothing like this, though. Pitch. You could light pitch on fire. You could burn something down. Nothing that would incinerate an entire land once it hits the ground. Poisoning the seas? Nothing like that. As we've already noted, there are 9 nations with nuclear weapons, and maybe 10, Iran. They might have one, they might not, not sure. And if you read history, once people get a hold of weapons, it is only a matter of time before they start to use them. Nobody gets a weapon and then just sits on it. Here's Nicholas Miller. He's out of Dartmouth. He says the U.S. isn't able to enforce non-proliferation of nuclear weapons in other countries. We can't stop people. We tried that with Iran. President Obama tried that sunset deal where we're going to slowly give you uranium, slowly bring you into the Western economy. Once he did that, President Trump got into office and he revoked it. Now the Iranians are like, we're doing our own thing. So we can't stop this. Once Pandora's box is opened, it can't be closed. He says, Iran stands closer to the nuclear weapons threshold today than at any time in its history. That's April of 2024. Hefland writes this, it's just a small nuclear exchange that he's describing. In this small exchange, smoke would rise between 20 to 50 miles above the Earth. 5.5 million tons of soot would enter the atmosphere. Rain would cease for years, and 1 to 2 billion people would starve. 1 to 2 billion, that's about a third of humanity right there. This guy's not a believer. He's not trying to fulfill Bible prophecy, anything like that. Alan Robach out of Rutgers. He says, a conflict between India and Pakistan, for example, in which only 100 nuclear bombs were dropped on cities and industrial areas, only 0.4% of the world's more than 25,000 warheads, would produce enough smoke to cripple global agriculture. You say, well, yeah, if you know, India and Pakistan got into a nuclear war, that would be localized. No. This would be a global catastrophe. What one country does is going to affect all of us. I can't resist. I can't. I have to do it. The high-altitude EMP shot. This is scarier maybe than all that put together. This is where you send up a nuclear weapon into space. And anywhere that you can see it from the naked eye sends out an electromagnetic pulse. This fries everything in sight. 100 miles into space would destroy any electrical devices, food supply, food delivery, sewage pumps. I mean, you'd think like, well, my iPhone wouldn't work, so what? No. Your toilet wouldn't work. Food, refrigerator, anything like that. Military experts have, quote, long suggested that U.S. foes like Iran and North Korea have been eyeing an atmospheric nuclear explosion over the United States that would kill electricity to half the nation. This could be an explanation why the United States is not in Bible prophecy. If something like this happened, we would be totally crippled. There would be no way to return from this. It would be a way that you could use nuclear weapons. You could cripple a nation and not enter into World War III. The doomsday clock. This was created by a team of scientists after the onset of Oppenheimer's atomic bomb. 1947, they created this fictional clock that showed how close we are to doomsday. The hand on the clock has moved back and forth 25 times over the last 70, 75 years. So you can see it here, times during the different crises around the world, Cuban Missile Crisis, yeah, it gets pretty close. However, when we zoom in 2020 to 2024, that's where we actually are within 100 seconds, 90 seconds, 1 minute to midnight. They're saying we are closer today to doomsday than ever before in the last 70 years. Is this plausible? Very plausible. Yes, very plausible. Whether you're looking at this from a spiritual or a secular perspective. We can't go on forever, and once we have technology like this, you can't just keep it under wraps. Eventually, this stuff gets out, and it seems to me that what John is seeing is precisely what we're seeing today in our modern world. Well, how do we bring all this together? First, at this point in human history, God is going to hand over the reins of leadership to us. This is what is referred to as God's passive wrath. God is so good. He is such a good ruler and leader of our lives that a way to show judgment is just to say, why don't you go do your own thing? You lead your own life. And I'm sure many of us here have experienced that individually. This will be seen corporately, collectively, across the globe, when God just hands over the world to his creation. This is a form of judgment to let us do what we want to do. And the picture that we see is just all out malice, warfare, hatred, very sadistic, very quickly. We're speaking about a period of only 7 years. Atrocious, it's horrendous, yet it's also very, very close to what we see in human nature. When humans go their own way, when they're fully autonomous, self-ruled, and there is no God, there is no transcendent authority, and we just do our own thing, what we see very quickly is that it goes south very, very fast. And this, too, is a very good demonstration that this picture of the future is very realistic, because this is precisely what would happen if God just let his hands off and let us do our own thing. What we're seeing in this chapter is a warning. Woe, woe, woe to those who are on the earth. It's a warning. It's a call. Do you hear it? Do you hear that call that you need to come back to God? That your own life, your leadership, your own life is falling apart. That there's things that are wrong in your life. Things aren't turning out the way that you thought that they would. You have certain addictions. You can't quit. You know, I started it, but I can't stop it. And realizing what I need is a good, loving leader in my life. Well, if you're at this point where you've reached a point of humility and you want to invite God into your life, there is incredibly good news. Jesus put it this way in John 6, verse 37, "Whoever comes to me, I will never drive away." I remember going out to a Bible study years ago, and a guy read that verse, and I was like, well, where's the catch? You know, like, you come to Jesus, and then what? Then you got to follow the Ten Commandments, and you got to change your life, and you got everything's got to be better, and you got to be moral. And he's like, no catch. There's no condition on Jesus' statement. What Jesus is saying, and in a stark way, is that if you come to him, if you pray in your heart, Jesus, I want you to come into my life. I want the forgiveness that you have. At that moment, that is a prayer that Jesus always answers. He will never turn you away. He never looks at anyone who has a heart that is humble and says, I need you in my life and I need the forgiveness that you paid for. And at that moment, not a second later, he will come into your life and you will have the security of knowing God. And that, my friends, is Revelation 8.